you are standing at the precipice of both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say Black Lives Matter rather than All Lives Matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. Today's episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise features a conversation on movement building for social justice between myself and three of my favorite thinkers and activists, Tia Oso, Davon Love, and Chris Crass. The dialogue took place in front of a live audience at the National Conference on Race and Ethnicity in Higher Education, NCORE, in New Orleans on May 31st. In our discussion, my guest, whose introductions you'll hear in the session itself, examines strategies for building effective intersectional justice movements across lines of identity, experience, and issue focus. What things get in the way of our movements? What are the lessons we can take away from past and present movements about how to push through those obstacles? Are there common mistakes we make in the work? And if so, how can we learn from those mistakes as we move forward? What's the role of white people in the work? Why is black self-determination such a vital component of justice efforts? And how is it often overlooked within both historical and contemporary accounts of movement organizing? We'll discuss all this and more on today's episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. So let's get right to the program. I'm really incredibly excited to have the three folks who I have with me. So let me just introduce you to them. I'm going to start on my left and just go around. Directly to my left is Tia Oso, someone I've had on the show before. Excited to have her back on. She is a transformational organizer and strategist, a community engagement professional specializing in social change. She currently serves as the director of impact at Revolve Impact, an award-winning social action media and creative company that utilizes radical imagination, art, and culture to transform global power, politics, and people. She's organized for over 10 years. She's led campaigns to mobilize thousands of advocates for issues in the public interest, including racial justice, public art, arts education, immigrant and refugee rights, prison abolition, voting rights, access to engagement, economic equity, pretty much any issue you can think of where human rights and social justice are involved. She has been involved herself. So please help me welcome Tia Oso to the stage. Next to Tia is Chris Crass, someone who I've known for over 20 years now, a good friend. He's a powerful speaker on the themes of coming together for racial justice, why anti-racism is vital for white people, lessons that can be learned from past justice movements, and how a vision of collective liberation can move us to effective action. His passion is working with students, faculty, and staff, as well as community members to connect to their deepest values, overcome divisions, and act with love and courage for racial justice. Chris is the author of two books, his latest, Towards the Other America, Anti-Racist Resources for White People Taking Action for Black Lives Matter, is a call to action to end white silence and a manual on how to do it. His other book, Towards Collective Liberation, Anti-Racist Organizing, Feminist Praxis, and Movement Building Strategy, draws from over 25 years as an organizer and educator and offers a firsthand look at the challenges and opportunities of anti-racist work in white communities. Please help me welcome Chris Crass to the room.
And last but not least is Davon Love, someone else I've also known for many years, consider a friend, a Baltimore-based political organizer and the director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, a grassroots think tank that advances the public policy interests of Black people. He is featured in the HBO documentary Baltimore Rising, which documents both his youth education work around public policy and his legislative work around police reform. Davon has been sharpening his oratory style and political thinking for more than a decade. When he was at Forest Park High School, he discovered the world of policy debate and was so good at it, he earned a scholarship to Towson State, where he and his partner, Devin Cooper, won the national championship for the Cross-Examination Debate Association, the first time in history that an all-Black debate team had won the national tournament. In 2010, Love co-founded Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, one of many groups that pressured the state of Maryland to disband its plans to build a juvenile jail downtown. LBS has also led legislative efforts to increase civilian oversight of law enforcement in Maryland and was a key force in fighting to get bail reform in Maryland and facing off with the bail bond industry that opposed those reforms. Davon is the co-author of The Black Book, Reflections from the Baltimore Grassroots, a collection of essays that describes important issues facing grassroots activists and organizers. His new book, Worse Than Trump, The American Plantation, will be released literally tomorrow. Please welcome Davon Love to the stage. So to get started, I want to get everyone in on this question, and we can start here and again go around the table. I'd like to know what you all think are maybe the two biggest challenges right now to effective organizing and movement building. And I'd love it if you could think of one external and one internal challenge. And what I mean by that is I feel like the external, the stuff that's going on out there in the world that we can't necessarily control, can affect how we organize, how effective we are at organizing. And so I want you to think of something that is currently a potential obstacle or barrier to effective movement building that is external. And then also internally within our movement spaces, what is at least one challenge that you see that we need to be addressing among ourselves, not just thinking about what's out there, but what's in here?
That's a good question. And good morning, everyone. So I will share one external challenges, kind of trauma fatigue, and not just trauma fatigue, but like the 24-hour news cycle and social media and just the rate at which people are taking in really scary, traumatic information and people feel very overwhelmed. And then the way that issues, human rights issues, are being framed in the media as though there are like two sides to things. And it just is a time where people are getting a lot of information, but not a lot of context, and then just feel very overwhelmed about whether or not they can do something, and if so, what. And it's, I'll say it's a challenge to movement building, because when you know that there are 50 million things happening, it can be really hard to get somebody to be involved, even in just in their local area, because they're overwhelmed with this onslaught of news about what's happening all over the world, right? And don't feel empowered to make a difference. And then the internal challenge I'll name is around the issue of celebrity activism, organizing, and then like what's actually makes change, which is like grassroots, one-to-one, in your community, in-person organizing. There's a lot of resources, and I now work in social impact and working with influencers, and it is mind-boggling to me how much money is being put into influencer engagement and social impact, which I want some of that money. However, having been a grassroots organizer for so long and fundraising on that side of things, it is amazing to me how differently resourced, high-profile, big-name events and activations are being resourced as opposed to grassroots, like door-knocking, canvassing, house meetings, political education, and how that's not being resourced. And so internally, whose eyes are on what, and specifically, I'm specifically talking about funders, is a really big problem.
Chris, what do you think?
Oh, good morning, and it's beautiful to be here with you all. I think a major external, so the work that I do is primarily trying to organize and develop the capacity in white communities for anti-racist and racial justice work. And so as an external issue is just the galvanizing of white rage around white people being the real victims of racism. So whether that's Trump, whether that's the alt-right, whether that's, you know, various, you know, right-wing forces that are actively working, which is not a new phenomenon. The Ku Klux Klan was talking about special rights during the civil rights movement, but it's at a pitch that I think is different in a way that the alt-right is going after higher education and campuses and trying to convince young white people on college campuses all over the country that diversity means white exclusion, that multiculturalism, multiracial means white people losing their place in society, especially white men. And so that external message is, you know, very loud and very clear. And there's a powerful message of your place in the world, your place in society, your place in your family is being taken from you by all these people of color, you know, by Obama, by, you know, on and on and on and on. So that's an external threat. But it's also an opportunity to be able to engage white people and white men in particular with a counter narrative of how anti-racism, how feminism is a liberatory force in the lives of white people and white men in particular. But it means being able to actively create another story, another narrative that can resonate and reach white people. And so an internal challenge is, I think it's a both and, where there's a lot of white people with the election of Trump who were horrified. And, you know, we were talking about it earlier of sort of like a, this isn't America, this is wrong, this isn't right, Trump is an aberration. And I think it, for me as a white anti-racist who is trying to organize millions of white people with thousands and thousands of other white anti-racist organizers, it's important to engage those white people from a, yes, this is absolutely horrible, and be able to work with their outrage and not push it down to like, well, this is actually how it's always been. This is America, which is true. This is America. So it's important for me to be able to engage the white folks that are coming into consciousness with the election of Trump from a wanting to support their outrage, because I want white people all over this country to be outraged by racism, to be furious, to be completely horrified, outraged, and want to take to the streets. And if they weren't aware 2 weeks ago of racism, but they are today, for me, I completely understand why for people of color, it's like a, how could you have not known 2 weeks ago that racism was a reality? But for me, I have to work with the reality of where white people are at. The reality of where white people are at is that everyday white supremacy wants white people to be completely spiritually, emotionally, politically impoverished to understand the reality of racism. And so I have to work with where white people are at, not where I want white people to be. So where white people are at is, if they're horrified by Trump, I'm not going to come at them and say, well, where were you 2 years ago? Right. I'm going to say, damn right we're horrified by Trump. Damn right we want to take to the streets when the Muslim ban goes. Damn right we want to stand up. And in the process of being damn right with them, be like, you know what? And this is how it's always been. Right. And we need to get free.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Excellent. Davon.
So actually, this is an extension of what Tia mentioned. Teofilo Benga, who's an African Senate historian, talks about the difference between history, historicity, and historiography. Mm-hmm. History just being things that happen, chronology. Historicity being about one's relationship to the flow of history. Historiography about the institutions that are able to dictate what narratives are popularized and highly circulated. I want to deal with the issue of historiography. We live in a society where we are conditioned and have internalized a white supremacist historiographical approach to activism and movement building that impacts the way that people understand what it means to make change. And what I mean by that is this. Many of the narratives that are popular in the American mainstream, both just in the general public and in the academic mainstream, are narratives about how black folks have petitioned a sympathetic white people for our freedom. And so in addition to that, part of what has happened is that the kinds of narratives we get about black resistance also fall into the realm of the kind of spectacles that in many contexts white folks find enjoyable to consume. Mm-hmm. One of the things I actually mentioned in the workshop I did yesterday around police brutality, I think one of the reasons why there's such high circulations of videos of black death is because black death is something that is consumed similar to the way the general public consumes horror movies, mm. right? That we become kind of enthralled in the spectacles of violence, but not the actual structure that creates the kind of oppression that we're all fighting against. So going back to this question of historiography, I want to give two really important examples. So the example as it relates to the issue of the spectacle, right? You think about Rosa Parks, you think about the Montgomery bus boycott. And what many of us are taught is, you know, Rosa Parks sat on the bus, refused to get off. It sparked this kind of spontaneous movement that ended segregation in Montgomery, Alabama. What most people don't know is that in 1944, she was a field investigator and organizer in Abbeville, Alabama, to investigate the rape of Recy Taylor. And she had 11 years of organizing experience before the Montgomery Improvement Association came to be. That you had years of organizing, particularly of black women in the church community, that had been organizing on similar issues for years. Dr. Martin Luther King was a person that was brought in. Edie Nixon, Joanne Robinson brought Dr. Martin Luther King in, knowing the kind of respectability politics that would make it so that Dr. King would get a platform, right? They were very intentional about that. Think about this, that in Montgomery, Alabama, in 1955, they were able to develop an alternative transportation system that lasted 13 months, mm-hmm. right? As a person that, like, I've worked in city government, there's city government agencies that wouldn't be able to do that, right? But what's important to take note of is that the questions of capacity of people of African descent to do the organizing and institution building. So it's not about how eloquent you are or your ideas. It's about the institutional infrastructure you build to operationalize those ideas. Black people have a rich history of doing that, but that's not the history that is most popularized. Mm-hmm. Second example I give, most of our narration of the end of chattel slavery. Mm. So most of us understand that there was the civil war between the North and South over slavery. What is really important to know, and you can read this in John Henry Clark's Notes on World African Revolution and Hubert Henry Harrison's, you know, Why Socialism, there are a whole bunch of texts that substantiate this, which is that the Haitian Revolution created a fear where the North was like, we don't want none of that, right? Because we see what DeMarvisi did, we see what Nat Turner did, we see that it's inspiring these people of African descent to engage in armed resistance. The South was slow, because their economy was based on agriculture, and enslavement was a necessary part of their economy. And so they were fighting because the Haitians were able to be the first republic that fought and won against the most powerful empire in the world and created a context, right, where black people were able to aspire for our own freedom. That narrative is important because it helps us reframe the focus so that our understanding of how black people were able to end chattel slavery was not about, you know, whether or not we're able to get enough sympathetic white people to join us, but it was a question of black people exerting our own agency and challenging these institutions. And part of the issue we're dealing with, back to Tia's point, as we talk about funders, is that many of the people who are funding, and so this goes to your question about the external factors,
yeah.
that those who are funding, those who are in academic institutions that are essentially curating the black folks that are most exposed to the public mainstream, are those black people that are complicit in many contexts of giving a narrative where our freedom is reliant on sympathetic white folks. And so I think it's important as we think about movement building, developing a different frame of reference so that white folks are not the center of and are not the ones that are curating the strategies, the ideas that are the foundation of the organizing and activism that people engage in today.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, excellent. Thank you for that. So I want to stick with a principle or concept that you sort of touched on, and it involves the historiography, particularly the way that we think of the civil rights struggle, which is probably for most of us where, you know, we sort of gain our entree into understanding race and anti-racism in this country. Is we, you know, we have this very stilted view, obviously, as you've articulated. What are some of the lessons that we draw correctly from that struggle, and what are some of the lessons that we draw incorrectly? And I'm talking specifically, let's say, from the period of the Montgomery bus boycott all the way through, let's say, the death of Dr. King, because it strikes me that a lot of people who are talking about racial justice will obviously hearken back to that struggle, and not without reason, but will say, well, we just have to do things like they did them. Or, again, not necessarily even knowing what that was, not even necessarily knowing all the work that was going on that doesn't make the history books. What are the things that were done in previous movements that are replicable and should be replicated? And what are some of the lessons that we draw incorrectly? And I want to get everyone in on this, because I feel like we can't assume this moment is like that moment. And we can't assume that the obstacles and the barriers and the pressures that existed then are exactly the same as they are now, although there is some overlap. So what are the similarities? What are the differences? And how does that, or how should that, shape our approach to the different racial justice and liberation issues and struggles that we're dealing with? You want to start, and we'll go back around that way.
Yeah. Sure. I think that most people have been taught to understand the civil rights movement as one big continuous blob of activism work. And it's really important that we disentangle that. During that period of time, there were a variety of different strands of organizing and work that was happening that's very different. And there are lots of complexities in that that I think are really important to tease out. I think one of the most important addresses to Black people and to the world at large in the 20th century was Malcolm X's Message to the Grassroots. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that speech is so important is because he does two things that I think are crucially important. The first is he identifies what he called the farce on Washington. He talks about the ways in which, you know, Stephen Currier, the Kennedy administration, pulled together the major civil rights organizations, developed the Commission on Civil Rights, gave them $800,000 to split between the six of them before the march and another $700,000 after the march. And that was the moment when, because before that, regardless of how you felt about the aims, trajectory of these different civil rights organizations, in a variety of ways, they were accountable to the grassroots. They were accountable to their membership around the country. Well, this was a moment when that shifted and that they became more responsive to the kind of liberal, institutional, white supremacist framework that has attempted to kind of co-opt the civil rights movement. And so it's important for us to understand that there are lots of movements that were not connected to the formal civil rights establishment that need greater study. The other thing that Malcolm X does in that I think is also very important is that he talks about the importance of the international struggle and how we need to look internationally to provide us greater context for the moment that he was in that moment, and I think in the moment that we're currently in. What I mean by that is that during the civil rights movement, what was happening at the same time was independence movements around the world. And that what made civil rights possible, this is crucially important, what made civil rights possible was that the United States could not maintain moral authority around the world, given the fact that countries around the world were gaining their independence. And so Brown becomes a capitulation of Cold War politics. Right, it's not about Black people, right? The Civil Rights Acts become about competing against the communists, competing against the Russians in the Cold War. Right. And the mistake that gets made is that, unfortunately, we're taught that that moment and the gains that were gotten, which people fought valiantly for, was about Black people. Mm. There are a variety of folks during that time that understood that the Civil Rights Movement was not about Black people. And I think I kind of end on this thought that I think we got to be very critical and be very conscious of the move towards integration. The notion of racial integration has become the kind of standard norm that people are taught is the equivalent of racial justice. And so it's important for us to study those organizations, study local history of organizing, right? I found great usefulness in studying local Baltimore-based history of organizing. You know, study Black organizations that not capitulate to the kind of integrationist impulse, and I think we'll find things that'll be very instructive for us.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Thank you. Chris?
Yeah, I think with the civil rights movement, for myself and for so many, white folks who are trying to figure out anti-racist work and racial justice, it's like looking to the civil rights movement for guidance. And I think that, for me, one of the mistakes is seeing it as the sympathetic white people who are being appealed to versus the white people in the civil rights movement who were liberationist. They weren't sympathetic white people. They were white people who were for liberation and understood that ending white supremacy was key to advancing economic justice, gender justice, justice on all fronts and all communities. And so people like Ann Braden and Carl Braden were incredible white anti-racist socialist Southern leaders based in Louisville, Kentucky, who worked regionally. So just imagine that you all got a newspaper in the mail tomorrow called the Southern Patriot. So imagine tomorrow you get the Southern Patriot and you're like, what is the Southern Patriot? So what would you imagine the Southern Patriot is? You might imagine it's a Ku Klux Klan paper,
exactly.
Or a Confederate paper. So Ann and Carl Braden, revolutionary socialists in the 1950s, we're putting out a newspaper called the Southern Patriot that was completely committed to winning the hearts and minds of white Southerners to advance the civil rights movement as a key struggle to advance human rights and human dignity for all people. The Southern Patriot was a newspaper that Anne and Carl Braden were using to try to appeal to the values, the commitments, not of who they wished white Southerners were already, but who white Southerners were, understanding that it's not white Southerners. And just be clear, Malcolm X said that if you're talking about the South of the United States, you're talking about anything south of the Canadian border. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to appeal to how white Southerners were being used by white supremacy to work against communities of color and maintain ruling class power. So oftentimes we talk about privilege and oppression, but we often don't talk about ruling class power, the people who have the power to make the rules by which the vast majority of us live. And so Anne and Carl Braden wanted to galvanize millions of white working class and poor Southerners to see the Black freedom movement as a key struggle to align with, to advance justice for all of us. So not to be sympathetic to Black people's plight and see Black people as folks who need to get helped by white people to get their freedom, but Black freedom movement as the leading edge, just like the Black Lives Matter movement is today, the leading edge in a human rights movement that can help us all get free to live in a better society for all of our kids. And so that for me is a key lesson. The other thing is, you know, Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, in the book Black Power, he talked about the importance of a lesson from the freedom, from the Mississippi Freedom Summer, of not just having white folks come and help set up freedom schools in Black communities. He said the key thing now, this was written in the 70s, he said the key thing now is for white people who want to end white supremacy to set up freedom schools in white suburbs. So for white people, and I would say for white people to set up freedom schools in white communities all over the country, in rural, suburban, big city, all over the place. And I'm from the suburbs, and I wanted a freedom school bad. And so for freedom schools to help free the minds of young white people from the poison of white supremacy and to align white people's hearts and minds to the Black liberation struggle and freedom movements and multiracial alliances as key to the humanity and dignity of us all. And so that for me is a crucial lesson. So not to try to create more sympathetic white people, although I would prefer a sympathetic white person to a racist white person. So it's a continuum. And so, and I understand for you, it's like, I don't know, a sympathetic white person might actually be worse. But for me, we're operating from different places. And so for me, I completely would understand why Black organizers are like, I don't want that sympathetic white person. But for me, who wants to move white people, I'm like, give me the sympathetic white person who has a leverage point to move them into a liberationist white person. Mm-hmm. And so I understand that we're in different places. And so I want those sympathetic white people because most white people have not been given role models of liberationist white people. They've been given role models of racist white people, yeah, or sympathetic, condescending, patronizing white people. And then they're trying to be like, who do I want to be? Mm. So we need to create more opportunities for young white people to be like, I want to be Anne and Carl Braden. I want to get free. Mm. I want to end white supremacy in my community. And I want to join a multiracial movement to free us all from this nightmare of white supremacy.
Well, and what's deep about that, and then I want to get Tia in on this, is it actually does dovetail with something Davon was saying in the sense that it's not what you just described is not by necessity an integrationist project. It involves white folks dealing with our shit in our communities while Black and brown folks are organizing in theirs.
Exactly.
We're on parallel tracks.
Exactly.
Headed toward a place of potential liberation, but we don't necessarily have to seek out that kumbaya moment where we're all in the same room. We may get to that place eventually once we've made some progress down the road, but it's a difference between integration as a means to an end or an integrated just future as an end that may require parallel activism, white folks doing our stuff. Like it's for us to deal with the sympathetic white person. It's definitely right. Not for y'all to deal with the sympathetic white person, unless you're feeling generous today, right? Like, you know, I mean, like, honestly, that's on us. That's our work. And if we're doing our work and Black and brown folks are doing their work and we're all aimed at a similar goal, then we don't have to have the acrimony. It's not, we can be coming at it from different places, but we're looking toward a common goal that doesn't require this condescension and doesn't rely on goodwill. Because goodwill can be snapped like that. You know, your financial situation changes, your family situation changes, something goes wrong in your life and all of a sudden you don't have time for the struggle. But if you know your life is at jeopardy, like you're at risk if you're not part of this struggle, your life depends on people getting free, then you can't be like, oh, I'm gonna take a break for like 3 years and I'll come back, you know, or I got some other shit to do, you know. And I think that's an important piece of this. It's not antagonistic what we're talking about. We're talking about folks doing their work on parallel tracks.
Right.
Tia.
I'll start with the positive. So one of the things that I felt like a lesson from the civil rights movement, and this is basic organizing, but also like keeping the momentum. So things like mass meetings and being very culturally centered, community centered, local grassroots centered, and like really prioritizing the coming together of people on a regular basis within faith institutions, within community institutions. People, when I'm doing my organizing work, people like joke with me a lot and they say, oh, Tia, you're always wanting to organize at parties and festivals and, you know, at the bike clubs and things like that, but that is where our people are,
right.
And so that's where I'm going to go, and it's a lesson that I learned real quick about organizing, and it's something that I learned almost backwards because my mom was an organizer, my grandmother was an organizer, but I didn't necessarily recognize it as that because they didn't call themselves organizers, you know what I mean? Like, my mom was an ACORN member. I didn't know what that meant, but there were people at the house all the time.
Right.
And so really prioritizing the gathering of people together, a connection, relationship building, very, very local, that I think that we could do a lot more of. And there's some organizations that do really great around that, like, you know, Black Alliance for Just Immigration. We have a kinship assembly every 2 years. Organizations like Black Youth Project 100, Million Hoodies, Black Lives Matter, you know, chapters that gather. But I do think that there are not enough. There could be definitely more mass meetings and then also more rigorous public debate. There are not a lot of academic institutions hosting debates and hosting like dialogues where people can talk about and like wrestle around these discussions like we're doing right now, which I think during civil rights movement, Black Power movement eras, there was a lot of that. And then even like prior to that, there were a lot more, just like public mass, you know, instead of thought leadership, like let's think out loud in public, right? And like wrestle together with these ideas, which I would love to see us do more of now. And then to Davon's point and Chris's point, I think that a lot of the model from the civil rights movement that we're resisting it now in this iteration of like Black movement building, but in general, how we allow like kind of patriarchal hierarchies and ideas of like what work looks like to dominate. And so the work of Black women being very much marginalized and not touted as leadership and not touted as organizing. And when we talk about the civil rights movement, we don't talk about the fact that, like Davon was saying, like it was in specifically the work of Black women, and not just in the kitchen, but kitchens is important as well, but like the political education and the child rearing and the gathering and the keeping like the heartbeat, the backbone, the drumbeat, all of those things, it was Black women. And we do not, right now we're having like a kind of, it's a contentious point around like centering Black women's leadership, and it's almost seen as like, well, what is y'all's problem? But this has always been a problem and we're just trying to correct it. And I think about like the women that we don't talk about, Ella Baker, we don't talk about Septima Clark, we don't talk about Fannie Lou Hamer, and just the ways that Black women and the way that women organize and what women's work and labor looks like and how important it is to actually building and sustaining a movement. And a lot of times, again, you know, the work that women do is not always seen as the work, but it is the organizing work, like being able to gather people together, being able to sing a song, being able to have everybody's phone number memorized somehow, you know, so that you can get the word out and turn folks out. That is real organizing work. And we do not, when we talk about movement building and we talk about what the work is, we're not talking enough about that. And it is a patriarchal view of what work is and what organizing is and what's important and what makes movements happen.
Is it okay if I want to add
please.
To that?
Yeah.
So because I think particularly at an academic conference is really important to really extend on the point that Tia is making. So using Ella Baker as an example, you know, one of the things that happens is that, see, white folks have entire bodies of intellectual work that are dedicated to particular people and institutions, right? So you'll have like Marxism, right? Entire bodies of work that see Marx as a paradigm for how to engage the world. And you look at the various different disciplines of human knowledge that are mainstream, right? That happens. But when it comes to Black folks, we'll talk about white people's ideas. We talk about things that Black people did.
Mm.
Is that Black people don't have ideas that can be turned and structured into institutions. So taking like Ella Baker, for instance. So at first, Ella Baker was working for the NAACP. She had a clash with the leadership of the NAACP because they were more interested in using the branches of the NAACP to finance a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. Ella Baker felt like, well, no, it's important that we use the branches as power bases in order to use that to put pressure, right, on the federal government. And she ended up leaving as a result of this particular clash. You look at her and the way that the SNCC, right, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was the brainchild of Ella Baker. That if you study her work, right, and you study the way that she approached organizing, which had to do with the understanding that your relationships and your networks and using the people who are of and from those communities and their networks as the strength of their organizing is a methodology of organizing mm-hmm. that should be rigorously studied mm-hmm. and understood the same way that we study Saul Alinsky.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So Saul Alinsky right. Rule for Radicals, you're supposed to have read that. You're supposed to have, you know, right. Many of us have been socialized by Industrial Areas Foundation and their kind of model of organizing. Ella Baker is a methodology as to how we approach organizing. So I think it's important and incumbent upon particularly those in academia to look at the work that black folks have done, but also look at the ideas that undergird the work and develop them, particularly those of us of color in these institutions, and to systematize them as methodologies that can be replicated.
Chris, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, just on for the Ella Baker's organizing methodology, the book I've Got the Light of Freedom by Charles Payne is, you know, all about Ella Baker and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's organizing. And so for me, reading that and trying to think about, okay, what does this mean for white people? You know, part of the white anti-racist, you know, framework, particularly in academic and campus places, is sort of a like, you know, and I completely understand this dynamic, is that, you know, you come into consciousness as a white person about racism, and one of your first instincts is to hate all the other white people, you know, which I totally understand. So it's like, I hate white people. I don't want to be anything to do with white people. But then, you know, Ann Braden, she said, you can't organize people you hate.
Yeah.
And we don't just need 2,000 really super woke white people.
Right.
Then capitalism trains us to compete against each other to see who's the best white anti-racist.
Right.
So then, you know, just like I'm the best male feminist. And the best way I can be a male feminist is by destroying every other man trying to do the right thing around feminism to prove that I'm the best. And so we don't want that. We want a socialist way of engaging that is building a cooperative power so that we are all awesome for justice, not I am the most awesome. And so for me, around the Ella Baker model, it's how to create ways in which tens of thousands of white people can be engaged in racial justice work that doesn't require them to have to have been through 10 years of rigorous critical race theory before they can go to their first demonstration. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I want to be able to create mass participation for working class, poor, suburban, all kinds of different white folks that doesn't require them to have to have gone through 8 years of higher education in order to be able to finally get to the point where they're saying, okay, I'm ready to make a public stand against racism, because, you know, you also start to internalize this idea as a white person that even showing up in public is problematic because you're reproducing oppression everywhere you go. And so white people become conscious and they become like, oh my God, the best thing I can do for liberation is stay in bed, you know? But the Ella Baker method is, how do we create opportunities for white people to engage in racial justice work that transforms them in the process of doing that work, but then also organizing in white spaces to say, you know what, we need to not ask the question of how do we get more people of color into our lives and into our organizations, but how can we as white people in white organizations or white churches be effective in the struggle to end white supremacy and advance racial justice? The question is not, how do I get people of color so that I feel like I'm okay? It's, how do I end white supremacy so I can get free?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. That all of the things that you all said, and something you said specifically, Tia, really made me think about this. When you talk about the way in which the work of black women in particular has been so marginalized within our larger understanding of the struggle, and you think about the way working class folks likewise have been marginalized, so that we see a group of relatively bourgeois leaders, and I'm not even using that pejoratively, like they have a role to play, but that's the term that applies, and they're the ones who were lifted up, and they are usually male, and they are overwhelmingly straight and cisgendered, and so, you know, you have entire cadres of LGBTQ organizers over the years within the racial justice struggle whose stories are not told. Working class, women as women, you know, religious minorities, you even within the civil rights struggle don't learn the way in which non-black peoples of color connected with black-led struggle. Those stories are not told. You don't really understand the connectivity between, you know, the farm worker struggle, let's say, and the black freedom struggle in the South. You know, we don't learn about that.
Or that the farm worker struggle was like also led largely by Filipino people. Like, who knows that?
Right, exactly. So this brings up the issue for me of intersectionality and how in this particular moment we have to organize in a much more conscious way, because a lot of that organizing, even when it was effective, was very much not intersectional. It was very much siloed. It was very much, here's what the men are doing, and then we think of women's activism as just the women's movement, as if that wasn't part of this larger struggle, right? And it's also a white women's movement, the way it's constructed in memory and history and media. So what does intersectional organizing mean to you? I want to get everyone in on this, starting with
with you and going around this way. What does that mean? And beyond what it means to you, what is it going to require seasoned activists to give up that they dearly cherish right now? Because it's easy to say intersectionality, and it's easy to that word falls off of our tongues relatively simply now. To the point where it's a buzz phrase. What is it going to require? Because I gather it's not as easy to do as it is to talk about.
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, shout out to Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw always. And hearing her talk about, like, how intersectionality is now a buzzword is really interesting as a theorist, right? Not just an organizer and all these things. I think that it requires us to, number one, understand that centering marginalized people is not something that you do to be nice. And coming with an intersectional framework and a lens is part and parcel of actually being liberatory, is part and parcel of actually organizing in a way that's going to undo systemic oppression. There is an art exhibit right now in Los Angeles around the Brown Berets and Latinx activism in general. And there is like these photocopied mimeograph sheets of when a whole group of women split off from the Brown Berets in Los Angeles and like their manifesto and like, the letters that they wrote to the leadership there. And the fact that this like really powerful organization had such a deep and insidious commitment to patriarchy that they would not allow these women to organize. They would not allow them to organize outside of like the women's auxiliary or what have you, that they were, you know, experiencing a lot of machismo, marginalization, sexual harassment, probably rape, all of these different things within in what was considered a politic, right? A movement, the vanguard of that movement. Intersectional organizing means that it's not an annoyance for people who are not being centered or whose needs are not being met or who are like pointing out the fact that this demands, this list of demands, or like our politics in general is trash right now, that they actually are not annoying us. They're trying to make our movement better and making it true to the liberatory framework that it is that we say we're espousing. We're not going to get free unless all of us are getting free, period. So that means if I am a Black trans woman and I say, hey, Black trans women need to be at the table, why isn't this one of the demands? Why isn't this one of the issues? That it's not seen as, right now it's seen as like kind of checking off the box, or, oh, it would be so nice if that was included, or like when we're, you know, establishing organizing spaces and there's not trans inclusive restrooms, which again is like we pat ourselves on the back for that, and it is a minimum. People need to go to the bathroom. Right. What are we so happy about?
Right.
Like, you know what, we remember to do that. Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
Right. And so it really requires us to be, you know, radically related to our humanity and to other folks' humanity, and organizing in such a way that we're not going to take one step forward without all of us moving forward together.
Yeah. Chris?
You know, so for me, you know, and I think again, like in academia, you know, I mean, I was, you know, I mean, I loved all my classes I took and my professors, and there also became a point where it almost seemed like the goal was to be as so super smart and sophisticated that you could annihilate anyone.
Right.
You know, and then it became a thing of sort of like, okay, am I trying to be like super smart? And like, and I understand, like I was trying to understand all these concepts and I was trying to learn all these things. And so intersectionality and all this kind of stuff. But then, so then, you know, when you said the thing about what is going to require to get out of the comfort zone. So for a while, there was a lot of us, you know, white anti-racist folks who were like, okay, we're going to create basically cadres of highly trained, highly politically sophisticated white anti-racist people that number in, you know, organizations of a dozen, 20 people at most, who are super sophisticated, but then who can do really good alliance work, multiracial alliance work, and then also do work in white communities. And that was really effective. That was really good. That was an advance from just individual white people. But then it came to a point of like, okay, we can't just have 30 organizations around the country of 10 to 20 people each. That's good. That's a build from where we were before, but we need to be able to start having organizations where hundreds and hundreds of white people can be involved and come into contact with racial justice work. And so that means we need to be able to create opportunities of entry points where people can come in where they don't already have it all figured out. I didn't get born intersectional. I got born into a white supremacist patriarchal society that raised me to believe that was just normal. And so when I got called out on my racism, it was like, oh my God. And then 2 weeks later, it was my sexism. I was like, oh my God. And so it's like, you know, it's like an it's this like evolutionary thing. And so to create, to have leadership that can hold an intersectional politics that also allows space for everyday people who have been deeply trained in a white supremacist patriarchal framework to also come into the organization if the only place they're at right now is Trump sucks and I want to do something about it. And then to have a culture that supports people to, over time, develop an intersectional politics and value system over time. But you don't send the person who right now says Trump sucks and doesn't have a larger politics, you don't send that person to the Multiracial Alliance Leadership Council where you're developing strategy.
Right.
So Ann Braden, going back to the Civil Rights Movement, Ann Braden would meet with Ella Baker and develop general strategy around organizing. And then she would go back to her base where there were people from all over the political spectrum, but who could get brought together into mass meetings around what's happening in the civil rights movement is important. And so your entry point might be, I'm a sympathetic white person. Your entry point might be, you know, I want to get free. But we want to bring all these white folks into spaces where they can start to come into the movement and trust the people that through experience, through exposure, and leadership that supports them, holds them, and moves them, that people can change over time. And again, in the academy, there's a sense, I mean, as a young person getting my consciousness raised, the people that I was the most frustrated with were the people who reminded me of who I was 2 weeks ago, politically. And so it'd be like that person in my women's studies class, that one other guy who I was like, oh my gosh, there's another guy in here. I need to prove that I'm the best guy in women's studies. It'd be like, oh my gosh, you said something so retrograde. That's what I said 2 weeks ago. I'm going to destroy you now. As opposed to, how do we get more and more men to understand that feminism is a liberatory force in their lives? And you and I are in this together.
So a couple of things. I'm actually troubled by the way in which I think that intersectionality has been commodified and troubled by the way in which I find many people deploy it. I'm going to start with the latter first. People of African descent have a history of revering the humanity of all people. And one of the ways that the notion of intersectionality gets deployed is that in the 70s and 80s, for the first time, Black people started thinking about gender and sexuality and all these other things, right? And we list some of the kind of foundational scholars, right, giving them their just due, but doing it in ways that I think create a notion of Black folks as being inherently pathological.
Yeah. And
that
it's ahistorical, like it's just
exactly,
like,
yeah. Right. And so what happens is that Black people that are proximate to many of the white institutions, the academic institutions, that are studying and that have been kind of socialized in kind of mainstream iterations of intersectionality, go to working class Black people and try to impose upon them a kind of a philosophical vernacular that does not speak to the actual condition. If you go to a high school graduation in the heart of West Baltimore, you're gonna find a variety of different kinds of Black people that are thinking about gender and sexuality, that are thinking about thinking about trans folks and thinking about all these different ableism, that think about all these different, like one of the things I come in contact with a lot are Black folks who either have children that have disabilities and that they're trying to do activism against the school system, mm-hmm. which in addition to them being Black also doesn't care about their special needs. So the intersectionality amongst Black folks both historically and amongst working class Black folks is, I think, superior to the understanding that many folks have in traditional mainstream academic spaces. Mm-hmm. And that's important because I think what often happens is that intersectionality then becomes a way to undermine the importance of Black self-determination. That there in the academy, there's this notion that there's an inherent tension between Black self-determination, what many folks call like Black nationalism, and intersectionality. And that there's this history that's projected onto Black people, particularly Black nationalism, that I think is important to identify. Black people have been socialized in a white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchal society. Nationalists are not the people who exude those characteristics, right? The entire what we call civil rights movement, that with patriarchy, homophobia, et cetera. But nationalism and academic, Black nationalism and Pan-Africanism in academic spaces gets projected onto it a particular kind of pathology around these issues. I would argue that in the kind of political and cultural milieu where people of African descent and our connection and self-determination has been central, have actually experienced more justice on these issues than in spaces that do not have that as that foundation. I can talk more about specific historical examples. One example I'll give is if you look at mutual aid societies, right, mm-hmm. that were formed during the 19th century. primarily black women, that organized mutual aid societies as the basis, the economic basis, mm-hmm. for what we call the civil rights movement,
yep.
right?
Yeah.
You look at the Gullah Islands off the coast of South Carolina, mm-hmm. majority black women that maintained some of the African cultural remnants as the basis for the development of the mutual aid societies there. So I just think that's really important, because going back to what we talked about in the beginning, this idea of petitioning sympathetic white people as the basis for our freedom, what oftentimes happens is that intersectionality becomes an excuse, I think, for some people in proximate to white spaces to use intersectionality and deploy it against the idea of black self-determination. Hmm. And then the other thing that I mentioned in the beginning about the commodification of intersectionality. So again, working class black people deal with a lot of these issues. The thing that really pisses me off is to watch the way in which black trans folks and their suffering is really used as a cute talking point to get some grants.
Yeah.
Because it looks good now to say I'm a center trans black people. I know a person who worked at a transitional housing program in Baltimore that primarily served black trans women. It was funded by a grant that dried up. So now those, and a lot of those women were involved in human trafficking, mm-hmm. right? So this transitional housing program, its job was to try to help them transition out of the life of human trafficking. But there isn't the same kind of passion around, let's invest in organizations that actually deal with issues that most directly affect trans black people, mm-hmm. right? Let's invest in, in counseling, in, the medication in terms of transitioning. Like, let's invest in what black trans people need.
Mm-hmm.
And so the commodification of intersectionality, as a person who was an avowed Pan-African nationalist, it frustrates me that what happens is that there are these wars about people who are not intersectional enough, coming from people that do not do the work of trying to get investments in the people that actually impact black trans people, black women, mm-hmm. black LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to transition our notion of understanding intersectionality to a framework not just of saying I'm a center of their lives, but really knowing the people doing the work and do what we can materially to mm-hmm. empower them to get the platform necessary to get the resources needed to sustain their work.
Can I say something to that? Yeah. I think that what you just shared is really poignant in that when we talk about intersectionality and like the way that, the buzzword way that it's talked about now is like we're talking about like issues of identity, but we don't include class often. And so I think that a lot of the issues where people have in actually centering, specifically like I'm thinking about like the black trans women that I know and the work that they do, is that people actually don't want to deal with the reality of like life of black people in general and like just all of the things that come along with it. Like those things are not familiar to them. It's not, cookie cutter. It's not clean. It's not cute. It's not something you would write in a funding proposal and be able to get money for, but it is like specifically the material need. Mm-hmm. Or like I think about in my own life where, I have several people in my family who are incarcerated and dealing with drug addiction and all of these different things. And like what they actually need is not a class or, a grant to like, break into STEM. Like they need housing. Right. They need drug counseling. They need, resources to help raise their children.
Yep.
And yes, they may or may not be quote unquote gang affiliated, but what business is that of yours? And do you actually care to help them get free? Or do you want to just talk about, these poor black people over here, or these poor black trans women over there? And I think that it becomes in a way weaponized, and we want these communities to kind of assimilate into a notion that is just more comfortable for people, when really a lot of the everyday issues that people are dealing with have to do with them being marginalized in multiple ways, right? Mm-hmm. And then particularly in ways that make it unsavory for people to engage with them.
Yeah. Thinking about, the intersectionality and just, so for me, I feel like what you said earlier, Tia, about like just staying in our humanity and the humanity of other people is so crucial. So a friend of mine, working class, first, she was the first person in her family to ever go to college. And, she went and she was reading all these, going to like these history classes, learning about people of color history for the first time, learning about, Marxism and socialism, all kind of blowing her mind. And so she went home and, she's having a conversation with her mom, in the working class community. And her mom says something to the effect of, it's a real shame what's happening to all the illegals around here. And my friend, her first reaction is, Mom, that is so racist. How could you say illegal? That is horrible. That is not how we talk about people. You're degrading. And she was just went off. And then later, she was like, you know what? My mom was expressing a sympathy, a solidarity, a connection, a compassion of something is wrong about all these deportations that are happening. That could have been a point of connecting to not the words that she used, but the heart of what she was expressing. And to recognize that her mom and many working class communities, white working class communities where I, you know, where I came from, illegal is just that's the common sense language that is handed to white people every day by white supremacy. So until white anti-racists can develop the capacity to support white people to have the language of liberation and the values of liberation and the practice of liberation, you know, her mom saying illegal, that was handed to her. She didn't choose to, I'm going to use racist language right now. It was just that was the way that she was raised, you know, to understand. And so to be able to then connect to her mom's heart of solidarity and connection with immigrant communities around deportation was that as a place of connection. But that can often happen around language and around trying to understand concepts of getting stuck in the words and not really resonating with the hearts and minds of where people are really coming from and where they're at, and being able to move with where people are at towards liberation and getting stuck on the terminology.
Well, that brings up for me what I want to ask the last question before we get some questions from the audience. So this piece about language, this piece about the intellectualism of this work, for a lot of people in this room who are in academic settings, they're in colleges and universities, it brings up this issue that you hear about all the time when you go to enough campuses and you visit enough such spaces where there's such an intense divide between, you know, you call it town and gown or whatever, between the people in the academic space and the people in the community. And those could be working class white folks, working class folks of color, combination of the two, whatever it is, because not only is the academic space privileged, you know, in a lot of ways, but it's also this arrogant sort of intellectual isolated space where we do learn what words to say and what words not to say, and we get this sense of superiority because we know some shit. And like you said, we might not have known it 2 weeks ago, but once we know it, it's like, how do you not know about this, you know? And so for people in this room who are wanting to connect beyond the four walls, so to speak, of their institution, because we have all these efforts, right? And most of them are pretty sad and pathetic, these community engagement efforts or, you know, community service learning, which really is usually based on a charity model, not a solidarity model, not a model of liberation. How do the folks in this room, if you could think of one way that they can begin to try to build bridges and connect with community folks and empower community folks, not go in and quote unquote help them, but actually provide the space and the resources for those community folks to free themselves, to be liberated from the systems of oppression that affect them. What would that piece of advice be? We'll start here and go back around.
That's a really good question. So one of the things that is, I would say, a big challenge in the mainstream academic space, many of the ideas and institutions that are at the center of what is considered being in the know intellectually come out of traditional mainstream white academic institutions. The bedrock of that is kind of a Eurocentrism that I think can be debilitating in terms of connecting to black people. And what do I mean by that? So I would argue that most people are not aware, for instance, of ancient African history. What has happened is even those of us that are anti-racist have been socialized in a notion of people of African descent where they've never seen historical examples of people of African descent engaged in high-level construction of important theories of the world or presiding over institutions marked as high levels of civilization. And what that does is that it does two things. It makes it seem as if the ideas produced by bodies of work that black people produce are not sufficient unless it's connected to white people's ideas and institutions. The second thing it does is that it makes it so it justifies exploitative relationships that exist between the black community and other institutions. And so I think the way that that has manifested itself is when we think about, for instance, you know, social democracy, and we think about, you know, like, what does it mean to believe in socialism? My argument is that an ancient African civilization, and this isn't to romanticize Africa, right? Because ancient Africa, because there were 2,000 different ethnic groups, tribes, societies, city-states. But when you study that on the whole, you have people of African descent practicing and sustaining systems of social democracy thousands of years before Europeans even thought of the idea. We should be using those ideas, using what ancient Africa, what folks in ancient African civilizations were doing, in terms of developing and constructing what it looks like to do it today. The second piece, and this is, you know, more directly to the question, working class black people are represented as people that don't have ideas unless they sound like ideas that white people have popularized. So if you're, you know, so like, let's take Malcolm X, for instance, right? White liberals love Malcolm X, particularly towards the last year of his life because of the disavowal of Elijah Muhammad. And so it sanitizes him, and white folks try to appropriate him into the tradition of socialism, Marxism, progressivism. What's important to understand, like I mentioned before, many of us aren't studying Malcolm X as a methodology. We're studying him as a radical Democrat, or as a revolutionary internationalist, right? Which can be useful, but a part of what happens is, and so there's in Baltimore, the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum, the director, Dr. Joanne Martin, wrote a book in the mid-90s about the black experience in social work. And one of the things she argues is that the social work profession made a mistake at the turn of the century because black people, working class black people that were migrating from the South into the major cities, had developed black helping practices in order to deal with the issues that black people were facing more effective than the formal social work apparatus. The problem is we don't see working class black people as having the capacity to produce something that can actually solve relevant human problems. So we approach working class black people as objects of people's thought experiments. And if we just get, you know, good enough on the high theory, right, on the intellectual ideas that are popularized, and give them these ideas they don't know, right, then their condition can be ameliorated. So I think it's really important that if we both develop a reverence for people of African descent's intellectual capacity historically, it then lends itself to ability to see in working class black people the ability for working class black folks to produce things that actually are more effective at addressing a variety of different problems. One example I'll give, if you read Medical Apartheid by Harriet Washington, one of the things that she argues in the book is that in early American history, as the medical profession is coming to prominence, that studies were done that said that the medicinal practices of Africans that had came over through enslavement were more effective at treating people's diseases than the formal medical industry, right? For me, those are important things to internalize. Because what it says is not that we got to teach these working class black people how to get free,
right?
But we have to institutionalize the genius that is resident in those communities so that they have the resources to sustain the work that can fix our own problems.
Excellent.
Well, I mean, I think thinking about the academic institutions, I mean, I think so often it's trying to put this stuff in systemic understanding. So it's not that colleges create this bubble of isolation and all the professors in there choose to, like, let's create this elite culture and look down on everybody else and then go out and try to, like, fix them from, like, a charity model. It's that capitalism puts real restrictions on what schools are able to do, and particularly radical professors are able to do in their budgets and their departments. And so there's constraints that are real. And so just to be able to acknowledge that we're not just making choices out of nothing. We have to work within the conditions that we have. And so being able to then say, okay, what, given these conditions, what are, you know, because I remember a lot of radical professors would say, you know, we keep trying to do all these things of community engagement where we're actually supporting the leadership of community-based organizations, asking them what they need and following their guidance, and we're getting a lot of pushback on our budgets being cut, and this isn't intellectually rigorous, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. So being able to find ways, though, of subverting that paradigm to be able to be the most radical, effective programs that I've seen have been with professors or program staff on universities who have long-term relationships with leaders within communities who are then able to be in relationship to say, okay, well, what is it that would be most useful for you? This is what I can, you know, I've got these law students. So I know at the University of Louisville, there's an amazing radical lawyer professor who has a long-term relationship supporting prisoner support work where legal students then are regularly coming in to do work around cases of prisoners who are trying to either deal with their wrongful convictions or dealing with complaints. But it's a long-term program that the professor is able to maintain through relationships with people who run this organization, so that the students might only come in for 3 months during their class, but the work is going over years of being able to support the organization and build up the organization's capacity. So it's that sweet spot of what is going to help the students learn, what's going to help that program be effective, but then also how to really meaningfully support the power building and leadership of community-based organizations. So that's what I've seen that's been the most effective. And again, I think going back to this question around class is so crucial, because again, working class white people are seen as that, you know, the working class white folks are the most racist, are like the most backward, all this kind of within anti-racist, you know, thinking. And over and over and over again, it's going back to this idea of a white anti-racist being someone who can really speak this like really amazing language versus helping. And again, I understand that it's an evolutionary thing, but being able to support, how can more and more white people who don't have the right language have the values and commitment and culture of solidarity that can bring them into multiracial organizing and also work within white spaces? And so again, the understanding the language and the concepts is useful in the classroom, but being able to develop a courageous humility of knowledge, of this knowledge is helpful, but it's also our people have so much information and so much wisdom. So in my family, working class family, you know, I would get caught up with my uncle arguing about racism all the time. But I would oftentimes not recognize that his daughters, my working class cousins, were doing all kinds of amazing stuff. And so it was more of like, okay, how do I stop creating such a platform for my racist uncle to monopolize the dinner conversation? Mm-hmm. And how do I ask my working class cousins, so how's it going in life? And then my working class cousin, after her father going on and on about, you know, undocumented immigrants, my working class cousin would start talking about how her best friend at school was her gay undocumented immigrant friend in band. And next thing you know, we're talking about a real human being who is undocumented versus we're having this like political debate with my uncle. So again, it's like but again, my racist uncle could become seen as that's the representation of white working class people, as opposed to my working class cousins who were in multiracial community, who were anti-racist, who, you know, that cousin who had that band friend, she's now one of the leaders of her union, you know, as a teacher.
Wow.
And so those are my working class relatives. Right. But I could easily make it seem as if all my working class relatives were my racist uncle. Right. So disrupting that and lifting up different leadership within my community.
Yeah.
I think that this question is really interesting, but the real question behind your question is like, what is the role of education and academia in society? And like, what are you supposed to be doing? And the model is like a Eurocentric white supremacist model about like what knowledge is and all of these different things. And so those kind of big questions need to be wrestled with. I think that academic institutions are positioned in our society and in our communities where they consume a lot of resources, public resources, land resources, social capital, right? So academics, even if they're not from a community, are positioned as experts in communities. I do not understand why. And so like really there has to be like a posture of divesting from those things and really like quite literally lending resources, giving resources away to community. And not even just organizations, but like building relationships with community and folks who are who can use meeting space, who could use funds, who could use catering, who could use whatever it is that you have access to give, like really divesting.
And with no strings attached.
Just build a relationship and start giving stuff away, because that is what that looks like. It's like really, like that's how you shift that. And then an example that I have is at Arizona State University, there used to be an organization called the Community Alliance for Black Student Success. And so just like what you're talking about, there were community leaders and university leaders. Some were staff, some were faculty, some were just, you know, folks who were graduate students there, but connecting with a group of community leaders on a regular basis to do very integrated ways of engaging and organizing in the community. And it got, of course, so effective that it became institutionalized and now it doesn't exist anymore. And that happened repeatedly, like in the history of Arizona State University, like really powerful black organizing gets cannibalized by the university. And so, and also like resisting that type of thing, like, you know, it's okay to have community leadership on academic projects. And some other really great examples that are happening right now in Arizona, where I was organizing before, is, you know, partnering with like refugee resettlement organization. So getting, you know, grad students and, you know, institutional resources along with, you know, refugee leaders in the communities to do work study programs, to pilot community gardens, like different things like that. So like really quite literally investing as much resources and lending as many resources as you can to community leadership and not positioning folks as experts, because the people in that community are the experts. The people in that community are the ones who have the solutions and who are operating sometimes from African indigenous ways of organizing. And yes, there are, you know, constraints and restrictions and things, but you know how to complete the paperwork, right, so that you can get what you need to get done, And those strings that come attached and those kind of boundaries and parameters a lot of times are to hinder, you know, that deep engagement and that deep investment. And again, in institutions that are taking up a lot of resources, like quite literally land, money, expertise, social capital, all of these things away from a local community. And that's where a lot of the tension, quite frankly, comes from, is that, you know, we can't even get a little bit, right, and are anything close to what academic institutions are afforded for our community issues.
Thank you for that. Well, we've got about 7 minutes officially on the clock. I'll go a few minutes over because I don't think they're using this room right afterwards. So I want to take at least one question. I'm sorry that this is a very imperfect science trying to do this in front of a live audience. So we are running tight on time. But if someone has a question that all three of the participants on the panel can maybe speak to. Yeah, go ahead.
So my name is Christopher Weiss from Syracuse University. Thank you for what you shared this morning. So it's been said that by bullet or blood clot, racism takes a toll. And I wonder if you all might talk a little bit about racial trauma. For instance, there was a study done on people in the Charleston area after the shooting, and the incidence of anxiety, depression amongst people of color was way higher. The trauma that was experienced by people of color was significantly higher. I'm wondering if you might talk on where and how, what are some pragmatic ideas that communities can offer some ways to heal from all of this stuff that we see on a daily basis?
Whoever would like to start.
One of the things that I'm really fortunate to have in Baltimore is a community of folks that actually, of people of African descent that specialize in healing work. And so one of the things I want to lift up, there's a sister named Shauna Murray Brown that has a practice called Kendra Wellness. We actually, LBS and Kendra Wellness, actually partnered to develop a program called Be More Healing Activists, which is basically a program where she and the other practitioners in Kendra Wellness help to address some of the trauma, particularly people that are doing activism work, deal with, and develop outlets for people to get the healing that they need. To go back to what Tia mentioned earlier, I think both the recognition that, because I'm sure that there are other organizations around the country that do that, and to advocate that institutions like that get investment. And the reason why I bring up Shauna, not just because of the work she does as a healer. So she's a licensed social worker and a astute Yoruba priestess and certified in mind-body medicine. She has a variety of different approaches to dealing with healing that draw from the cultural resources, right, of people of color, of indigenous people, people of African descent, that are important tools that often aren't going to be funded by mainstream academic institutions. So I think it's important to be very intentional about investing and advocating for investment, public dollars, philanthropic dollars, into institutions like community-based institutions like that to address the issue of trauma and healing.
I'll lift up another resource, Community Healing Network, and Dr. Cheryl Grills and her team have developed a model of emotional emancipation circles, and they hold space in different communities. They'll do workshops, they do trainings, and they're really, really awesome. And so I want to lift up that organization in particular, and also the fact that it's very important to address not just in community-based trauma, but at academic institutions. And I know that there's been a lot of discussion about this, but just wanted to lift that up as well, is that when there are these highly publicized racialized incidents, you know, the effect that it has on students of color in particular, and like really being intentional and explicit about allowing space and time and acknowledging that somebody's academic performance is definitely going to be impacted by that. And, you know, people of color who are working in higher education, your work performance is probably being impacted by that as well, too. We need to be acknowledging these things and talking about these things and centering the importance of healing and holistic practices. And even if there are people here who are on like faculty and staff, like, you know, policies around what types of services are offered on campuses, you know what I mean? And are those services open to communities? Just really being intentional about that and not just acknowledging it, but then also like, what are some ways that you can be investing in the solutions?
Right. Working in white communities, you know, I mean, white supremacy is a devastating force in the lives of white people. A friend of mine, you know, Terrence Priester, the first, you know, black person who I ever like talked politics and history with when I was, you know, a teenager, you know, we were talking and he had all these, you know, images of black leaders, and I didn't know who any of them were except Dr. King. And eventually we got to a point where he said, you know what, I'm not trying to teach you about my leaders, I'm trying to teach you about your leaders. But white supremacy has raised you to believe that people of color have no leadership to provide, let alone that they are your leaders too. Mm-hmm. And so white supremacy malnourishes you as a white person to the most crucial liberation movements, liberation history, liberation vision. And so your mind, your imagination is literally strangled into believing that supremacy and hierarchy and authoritarianism and violence is the only way that people can ever be with each other. And so it leads you into a life of desperation, depression, isolation, anxiety, which is what capitalism and white supremacy wants. And so for white people, then depression, anxiety, suicide, drug use, violence, seeing people of color, white men, seeing women as threats, as people to exert violence and force and power over, all comes out of this pathological fear of life, fear of humanity that white supremacy breeds within white people. So for me, racial justice and anti-racism is not only a liberatory force economically, politically, socially, but it's also a healing force in getting the poisonous cancer of white supremacy out of the hearts and minds of white children and white people to be able to embrace not only the humanity of people of color, but to be able to come into my own humanity as a white person, to be able to get free from what anti-blackness is both a target against black people, but also a training for European people to become effective workers within capitalism and to hate black communities and to hate themselves to the point where European working class people turn themselves into tools to advance profit for the rich. Mm-hmm. And so it is about destroying our humanity as people. Mm-hmm. And so for me, racial justice is a healing force within white communities that needs to be connected to the liberation of all people. And so being able to see it in that context. And there's an organization called Freedom Beyond that is creating healing circles for white folks that connected to racial justice, but also using it in a way that's for healing, and also multiracial people that are white passing to be able to connect to the healing around this work as advancing in terms of also advancing racial justice multiracially.
Fantastic. Well, thank you all so much. Thank my guests, please.
That'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show. And look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song Gather Round as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time.